The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
We may have nothing to lose but our chains, as the Communist Manifesto declared in 1848, but the revolution is still stuck in the eternal future tense of that promised someday. Jonathan Leatham examines what's left when the fires of a radical youth burn low in his latest novel, Dissident Gardens, charting the course of Rose Zimmer's life from communist agitator in Manhattan to community organiser in Queens. Leaping back and forth in time, Leatham constructs a through-the-looking-glass history of the American left. But when he read from the novel, he started right at the end of this story, with a searing indictment of Rose's entire life from her former protege, Cicero Lookins.
We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace. We shall.
"I hate her," blurted Cicero's smoldering charcoal of a head.
"Who?"
"Rose. She's dead." Sergius spoke as if he thought Cicero had led them this distance to sea for fear Rose would overhear them on the shore, and he wanted to reassure Cicero this was impossible. "Hated, then. You were with her to the end." "With her?" The word, however seemingly neutral, suggested a certain agency. Cicero'd known people who'd been with Rose Zimmer, notably his own father, a choice Cicero might never forgive. Cicero himself was under Rose and endured Rose, with Rose in the sense that the earth was with its weather. And that was when Cicero heard himself begin to rant. "It isn't just me, Sergius. All Sunnyside hated Rose. No one could confront her in the smallest regard except your mother. But your mother's confrontations died in Rose's silences. They died before the receiver was back in its cradle. Meeting her as a defenseless child, my tongue was bitten to pieces before I understood it was for speaking. I had to get away to learn to open my mouth. Yet if she was in front of me now, I'd probably fail to speak truth to power. For don't kid yourself, Rose was all about power. The power of resentment, of guilt, of unwritten injunctions against everything, against life itself. Rose was into death, Sergius. That's what she dug about Lincoln, though she'd never admit it. He emancipated our black asses and died. Rose championed freedom only with a side order of death. In Rose's heart, she was a tundra wolf, a Darwin creature surviving on treachery and scraps. Every room contained enemies. Every home was half spies, or more than half. If you mentioned a name she'd never heard, she'd rattle out like a Gatling gun. Who? Meaning, if they were valuable to know, why weren't they already part of her operation? If they weren't, why trust them? Why even mention them? She wanted to free the world, but she enslaved any motherfucker she got in her clutches. Now go back to Philly and write yourself a song cycle about that." The trouble with his rant was that time, like a grape blistered by the sun, seemed to Cicero to peel away its organizing skin during the interval of his delivery. The now, so oppressively reliable, dissolved. Cicero had become too much the master of this art in the classroom, of unspooling his anger to filibuster any other voice, letting extemporaneous phrases give birth to one another in a kind of generative storm, while his mind voyaged elsewhere. In this case, what was left of the grape when the skin peeled away was a heartbeat of somatic memory, a moment that had never stopped reenacting itself in some part of Cicero's body. A titanically willful woman of 40-something years, clutching the hand of a round-faced, baffled African-American child, perhaps just 6 or 7 years old that first of the seeming 100 times she dragged him along on her rounds. Rose Zimmer, his father's lover. She powered with him along the sidewalks of Sunnyside. Greenpoint Avenue, Queens Boulevard, Skillman Avenue, as she made her way, spying, gossiping, interrogating, whispering asides, projecting the grid of invisible importances in her brain over the network of streets, onto the apparently innocuous array of semi-populated park benches and barber shops, onto human beings with shopping carts moving so slowly along the pavement that they may as well have been frozen. The boy coming to consciousness from within this disordered moral map, which had overwritten any other. His being granted access to Rose's confidences, her ready faith that he could be the repository for them, first inkling of his own complexity. The fact that she reveled in the dismay and indignation generated by his presence at her side, the outlandish enlistment of the black boy as the righteous commie Jew divorcee's right hand, first inkling of his own brazenness. The two of them set Sunnyside aflame, and then visited her favorite soda fountain, whose shopmen and regulars loathed Rose as violently as anywhere else, and soothed themselves with chocolate malteds. Then, having loaded up on comic books and Pall Malls, she delivered him home.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have.
So I want to start by bookkeeping, really. I was just wondering, when you started working on Dissident Gardens?
I started it the minute I finished Chronic City, because that book was published in 2007, and I was probably already trying to write this book. I thought of this book as being about my, well, you know, it was sourced in my thinking about my grandmother and her relationship to my mother. I knew that I was sourcing this book in my limited information and my vast projections and fantasies about my grandmother's, well, both her, you know, political life and her sort of her sexual life. What had gone on in the time when I was a child and couldn't have fathomed what, you know, what she was all about. This was my chance to kind of go back and decide what I thought it was all about. So the connection to family history was very legible to me. But you start with that, and then it opens up these vast problems. Novels have their own formal demands. Once characters are up on their feet, they exist in a world that's not this one, that has to be fleshed out on the terms of the book. I'd love to say that I relied on family history, but it actually wasn't enough.
And what a family you turned them into. Yeah. I mean, they're amazing. I mean, Rose Zimmer is just this extraordinary kind of force of nature, and her daughter as well, Miriam, who's just kind of, again, a sort of extraordinary character zipping through the book. I mean, was it a question of following the voices?
This was very much a voice book, but I began in a way with this sense that the past was in dispute, that family histories weren't something you could just go back and kind of in some temperate, level-headed way explore, or that a novelist could simply unveil either the intimate lives of these characters or the meaning of their political affiliations. But that these things were, you know, for want of a better word, they were dialectical. They existed as a kind of impossible quandary. Anytime you glanced in the past, you were enmeshed in these perplexing, you know, everyone with a grievance, everyone with a bias, everyone with an agenda, and no way to sort it out. All I could do, in a way, was just open up this volcano of voices and opinions and aggravations and try to do my best job of witnessing it, you know, abiding with it.
And in the book, it's the women who are winning these arguments. They're shoving the men out of the way, almost.
Yeah, they're sort of the pivot, and the men are in a kind of centrifugal position. They're flying around, barely tethered to the women, right?
At the same time, it's a kind of history of the American radical left. It's kind of through the looking glass version of 20th century America. And Cicero himself says that he's got stories that don't find themselves getting told on his mind.
You know, I think that in a very superficial way, in some way, there are these sort of pat visions of what the 50s and 60s are like and what they're about and what their legacy is, what their implications are for our present. And so, yes, I wanted to kind of do a certain amount of witnessing, simply saying lives were lived with these kinds of absurd, intense, extraordinary commitments that didn't just evaporate into smoke. People declare the presence of an American communist movement a kind of a historical absurdity, or if they believe it was kind of decisively embarrassed out of existence. Well, the human beings weren't embarrassed out of existence. They went on from that point. And, you know, what did it mean to them to give so much of their lives to this kind of vision for how things might be different?
There's not very much in it about the working class. So this is very much a kind of a parlor history of communism.
Yeah.
It's not the factory floor.
No, I think that's right. It's about the people who adopted it as a position. It's about ideology and living your life with an intellectual commitment that becomes an emotional stance and becomes a way of life. But it doesn't arise from their fate as workers. That's the stuff I had the most intimate access to and that I identify with. You know, you see this arise in various moments, the agrarian fantasies of the parlor communists of the 1930s, who all wanted to be...
chicken farmers in New Jersey.
Absolutely. And of course, this is a deeply American fantasy. It has to do with this image of the frontier, and it connects to all sorts of things that the counterculture produces, even believing itself to be apolitical. You know, the Beat Generation, the sort of throwing over Columbia University to hitchhike their way out into the West and ride the rails.
All this that is space out there, isn't it?
So much of this overlays typical American fantasies of escape and individualism and a kind of lawless frontier where self-reinvention is possible. Well, communists and idealists and utopian thinkers in America have also been susceptible to the same projection that maybe it's not in the cities, it's not in books, it's something to be discovered by kind of throwing yourself out into that frontier space. And you see this in the 60s with the Back to the Land movement once again.
Another kind of space that you've used in this book is the space of time. You've got a much larger kind of scope here.
Yeah.
Was this partly so you could see Rose age, so you could sort of chart her from youthful firebrand to kind of her dissolution?
On the level of the characters, I was absolutely committed to the kind of the full outcomes. I wanted to measure the disappointment, the grievance, all the way to its end point in several of these lives, in generations worth of lives. So it meant the book had to have this very sprawling historical backdrop. But I also really wanted you to feel the strange connection between the lives of people who discovered one kind of dissident idealist worldview in the 1920s and these others who, you know, the ones I grew up with, who were reenacting some of the same feelings and behaviors in the 60s and early 70s.
Is that partly why you wanted to tell the book in chunks, in shards, told from the point of view of a selection of characters, that
yeah.
you wanted to line the people's lives and indeed their ideas directly up against each other?
I think that's right. I wanted you to feel the continuities, not as a kind of seamless flow of historical narrative, but instead as a kind of, again, in that argumentative sense, like, well, look at this, but then again, look at this, a kind of juxtaposition of different claims.
Sergius Gogan says he wants to write a cycle of songs
yeah.
about it instead of a book. Is that
right.
is that kind of what you had in your head?
Well,
kind of melodies playing
sounds so
each
good.
Other.
I want to consent to it. I never consciously thought, oh, the structure of this book will be like a song cycle. I think I saw it more as a kind of a mosaic piece. I think I tend to, when I look at the formal decisions I'm making in books, partly because I was trained as a painter, I look at them in a sort of plastic terms, sculptural terms. You know, this was like a double triptych of panels or something. It was a series of close-focused tableaus that when you put them all together made a world.
But it wasn't an extended joke on the divisions of the left.
Well, it could be that too, right? That sounds good.
There's a lot of ironies here.
Yeah.
Did you put the jokes in partly to kind of keep your morale up as the kind of inevitable disappointment comes?
Well, you know, I mean, I do think it's a very funny book. I laughed a lot writing it, but some of it's very dark. I guess, you know, for me, the 20th century is a calamitous joke on almost anyone who believed that they could make a meaningful political movement or a political identity for themselves. It was a Rube Goldberg device, you know, a catastrophe for anyone. You're going to end up dispossessed of your confidence and your views. And so that is a kind of a sour comedy.
Your characters offer up a host of reasons as to why communism never really took root in America.
Yeah.
Was that one of the reasons why you wanted to write about this, to find out for yourself?
Well, it's not a history book, and I don't really have that nerve as a writer to want to make a historical foray for the purpose of figuring something out. What I wanted to do was feel my way into the lives of people who'd given themselves to these now seemingly anomalous life choices, you know? And, of course, what I did feel I discovered was that they weren't anomalous, that it was a very American kind of life to live, that it was, in fact, an outgrowth of the fitful idealism, the disgruntled idealism that I think created the country in the first place.
The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
Where Jonathan Leatham's Dissident Gardens is published in the UK by Jonathan Cape. Like Rose Zimmer, Professor Lynn Siegel has never lost her radical edge. Her latest book, Out of Time, explores the perils and pleasures of becoming old. When she came to the studio, Siegel explained that her continued political engagement was nothing out of the ordinary. Most of the leftists and feminists she's known for 40 years are still causing trouble.
Now, I was thinking how different things have turned out for many of us from our dreams of the 1970s, when we thought life was going to be very different, almost the opposite from how it is now. You know, things, we were going to be more equal, we were going to be sharing things. It was just going to be a more nurturing and caring world. And of course, what we got is the opposite. But as well as that, there was so much emphasis on collectivity and people like me living communally. And many of us who are doing that are now living on our own. And also, from having spent our early young life objecting to too many men being too intrusive with us, suddenly from early middle age, you start to notice they're not being intrusive at all. And a lot of women end up on their own rather unexpectedly and, you know, trying to rethink how you still can be true to what you saw as your politics and yourself in old age. Yeah, was what I was thinking about.
But it's not that old canard that as you get older, you get more right-wing, is it at all?
Not at all. If anything, the opposite. I think some of us are quite determinedly political, no matter how old we've become. Most of us tend to feel, in one sense, we stay the same. At the same time, we're so aware of how we're aged by culture. We're so aware that we're seen differently. And yet this thread inside of a certain continuity seems to be there. Doris Lessing said, the real secret is that we never change at all. Even when we're 80, we're still the young person we used to be. But politically, I think for people like me, it's a sort of resistance that keeps us going.
You describe very different experiences of ageing for men and women, with Simone de Beauvoir lamenting the loss of her allure, whereas Philip Roth is mourning the loss of his sexual potency. Is ageing necessarily different for men and women?
I think there are always certain gender differences. It's interesting, The Guardian itself said recently that I've started a new genre in books on ageing. Not really true, because people like Penelope Lively and others have been writing, and Diana Attill have been writing about ageing and old age for some time. But nevertheless, there are quite a number of books coming out, and most of them are written by women. And most of them are saying, you know, we're going to age in the way we want to, and old age is fine for us. Now, this is interesting to me because it's actually women who are far more likely to end up on their own from middle age. And it's also women who are far more likely, as they get older, not to have intimate people caring for them. You know, there's a stark difference between the situation of men and women there, in which it seems that women lose out. And what's more, women age much faster than men. And yet, interestingly, in the actual literature, it's men's moaning and men's anguish that is very much to the fore, and of course in those men who have written most about old age, such as Philip Roth and Martin Amis and so on, and they're very much talking about, you know, the perils of phallic failure, as I see it, when the confident youth morphs into the shabby old man. So they're talking about that, whereas the women, I think, particularly those in the public eye, such as Germaine Greer and others, are trying desperately to give this very bouncy, confident line. No, we're all right. And one way in which we're all right, as Virginia Ironside says too, is we've left sex behind. You know, we're now free at last, Germaine says, to simply be the healthy, carefree people we always were. And I'm a little suspicious of that, and that's why I turn to people like Doris Lessing and Simone de Beauvoir, who do talk about the anguish and humiliation they feel when they're no longer at all seen as erotic people, and so they feel they have to give up on their desires.
is it not just a process like aging reveals these differences? And I mean, for example, process people who are older are often seen as being weak or fragile or dependent, which are also things which are stereotypically associated with ideas of femininity.
That's absolutely right. And I think that a lot of men's fears, particularly those men like Philip Roth and Martin Amis, and some men have said it quite explicitly, the fear that ageing will turn them into women, or at the very least it will neuter, as some of them say.
Finally make them into the second-class citizen
that's right,
they've been
that's
fearing
right.
all along.
Yes, that's right.
You're very tough on the idea that you can age well, the idea that positive narratives of ageing are complicit in the disparagement of older people. But what's wrong with just trying to stay healthy?
Well, of course, there's nothing wrong with trying to stay healthy and happy and fit. But I see that there's a complicity between the talk of aging well and forms of neoliberal thinking that we can all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and we don't need to make any demands on anybody. And I think it's also complicit with the horror of dependency and fragility and the fetishism of free choice. And I want us to rethink quite a number of things, you know, beginning with rethinking dependency and to say we're all dependent, however young or fit or male we might be, we're still in every way dependent on the support and the care of others on the one hand. And on the other hand, what's wrong with being dependent? We need people to care for us. I want to rethink care. It's not only that we are all dependent, but if we really don't have other people to care for and look after and worry about, then we're not going to be leading full lives at all. You know, we're going to be, it seems to me, cut off from many of the essential emotions that are part of life. That's one thing. And the other thing that's also part of life is sorrow and loss. And that comes in very early on, not just in old age, but the older you are, the more you're likely to have experienced sorrow and loss. And you know that it'll increase as your friends die off and so on. And so thinking about how to deal with that, there are ways of dealing with mourning and loss, which are also keeping you attached to life. People who die don't simply die. Right now, I and almost everyone I know is mourning the loss of Stuart Hall. My world at the moment is full of people reflecting on him. You know, he is incredibly much there, and I think he will stay there for us. You know, the dead do remain.
It's inevitably that as you get older, the sadness will increase in some sense. What about the idea of accruing happinesses as you go along?
Well, there's a couple of things to say about that. First of all, you're more likely to experience loss, that's for sure. But you're also, hopefully, more able to deal with it. When you're grief-stricken when young, you feel this will last forever and I'll never recover, some people might feel. When you're old, you just know more about how to think about loss and how, as I've just described, to keep people with you, to keep people inside of you. And there is another side that I do talk about. I have a section called Saving the Moment, which is about living in the present, but it's not living in the present in the way, in a purely hedonistic way, we must have as much joy, etc., in the moment, but rather slowing down and just being able to be there in time, be in the space you're in. You know, the metaphor is watching the drop fall from the leaf, you know, just seeing what is it around us that's beautiful. And that's certainly how many people who are growing old and more fragile are able to enjoy life, just looking out at it and not endlessly caught up in tomorrow and what's going to happen in the future, because the future is already the present. The point, I think, as you age is this saving the moment, living in the present, knowing that the present is, in a sense, already the past as well.
You explore the idea that as we get older, we encounter the world through complex layerings of identity. But I'm wondering how you deal with identities which have different beliefs. How do you deal with a self which is constructed out of conflicting ideas?
We really are different people in our heads. I mean, we only have to fall asleep and we can be that 17-year-old young girl or boy who was totally confident in the world, although perhaps also totally worried about all sorts of things in the world. And so in the temporal vertigo I'm talking about, I do think we swing between different pictures of ourselves. But I suspect that we're still likely to be holding on to some set of primary beliefs that have told us who we are. For someone like me, of course, it's being a feminist, being on the left, and needing to do the work of reaffirming that. That's what I think I'll always be doing all my life, and that's going to be something that allows me to be this person I've sort of constructed as to who I am. Because at the same time, I am aware that, oh dear, I'm too selfish. Oh, I don't really care enough about other people. You know, really, we're aware of contradictions within ourselves all the time. And the more we can tolerate that, can tolerate the ambiguity.
Are there parts of your kind of mental life that you've been forced to abandon, bits of yourself that you've said, no, that doesn't work anymore? I'm wondering about your experience of communal living, for example,
yes,
about the instabilities that of unconventional families, yes, which you've kind of discovered.
Yes, and worrying about, is this the best way to bring up children and so on. I mean, I still share a house with two other people, and often there's three or more because someone comes to stay. But we much more have our own clear space, and we very much negotiate when and if we eat together or what we do together. So I think it's stepping back from certainties, stepping back from any rule-bound notion or any moral ideas of, well, this is the best way to live. You know, I don't think I ever thought too strongly about what was the best way to live. It was always, how can I manage?
You examine a host of writers, I mean, such as Simone de Beauvoir and Philip Roth, as we mentioned, or there's also Adrienne Rich, Grace Paley, and others, to try and understand how we think about old age. But I'm just wondering if literature can really reveal what we're thinking on the inside.
Well, that's an interesting question, because a lot of people want to know, why didn't I do interviews with people? Why didn't I get to the hard facts and the nitty-gritty of what people have got to say? But of course, what people say is usually just the conventional wisdom of the moment. And so what they say is, well, I don't feel old. Oh, well, no, I don't have a problem. And it seems to me you have to step back from the cliches of the moment and think really deeply about the contradictions of life, the things that are very hard to say. And that's why I turn to literature, because I do think it's more likely in literature, in all the years of labour that goes into constructing, whether the works of prose such as Simone de Beauvoir's and her comprehensive look across time and place to think about how people have seen ageing, or those men or women who are usually genuinely trying to look into their soul to pull out the contradictions, not just saying the first thing that comes into their head. That's the value of literature, is that you spend a long time thinking about contradictions and the ineffable in life.
You cite Joan Didion asking if it's only by dreaming or writing that she can find out what she thinks. Is that partly what you were doing when you were writing out of time?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I begin by talking about the difficulties I have in even admitting my age. I still have difficulties doing that. And I share everybody else's anxieties and horror, not just of mortality, but of aging, of course becoming these dependent and fragile people that we all, the shabby old people that Freud, for instance, was so frightened of when he saw his own reflection in the mirror, becoming a shabby old person of no use to the world. And it was only through writing this book that I began to find it easier, still not easy, but easier just to think of, about the fact that everybody will get old. So thinking about the significance of intergenerational contact and how wonderful it is to know young people and younger people, but also that it's good for young people to know old people, not just their parents and grandparents with whom they'll have a special relationship, but people whom they've admired, people who I guess are mentors and they'd like to be. And that's when I would come back to not just Stuart Hall, who I also always mention, but people like Grace Paley and Adrienne Rich, who age with such, not style, age with much anger and regret, but also with determination and passion, and who say, as Doris Lessing said explicitly, that the only way to age is to care about other people's lives. Actually, that's what Stuart Hall also says explicitly, and I close the book saying, with his words, saying life isn't just a self-project. You know, as long as you care about the lives of others and genuinely care about the lives of others, then you're still attached to the world. And not just care about the lives of others, but insofar as you can share your thoughts, insofar as the world still has some interest, and by the world I just mean a few people around you, has some interest in what you've got to say or what you've lived through, then you're a fortunate and lucky person who can still find a point to life, a meaning in life. Because I think from very early on, you can start to think, what is the point of life? You know, I think, of course, in our teenage years, we often think that. Barbara Ehrenreich's got a book coming out soon in which she talks about this complete crisis and breakdown she had at 14 when she started to ask the question, what is life for? What's life about? Well, I think there's a sense in which that question comes back all the time. And hopefully the older we get, the more we might be able to see that, well, life certainly isn't just about me. It's about how I connect with others. It's this bigger collective thing. And insofar as we can see that and try and engage with it, then we have hopes of living a full life with all its joys and its miseries and its achievements and its losses. You know, all those contradictory things that I turn to people like Grace Paley and Adrian Rich and others to look for.
Even after you grow old, baby, you don't have to be a cold baby. Keep young and beautiful. It's your duty to be beautiful. Keep young and beautiful. If you wanna be loved, da-da-da-da, don't fail to do your stuff.
Out of Time is published by Verso. Thanks to Siegel and to Jonathan Lethem. Next week, the revolutions continue as the San Francisco novelist Armitstead Maupin comes to the Guardian Book Club. You can find all this and more on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Tim Mabey, thanks for listening. Until next time, here's a gem from Alice Walker's blog as she examines the question, what do I get for being old?
I get to meditate in a chair or against the wall with my legs stretched out. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to snuggle all morning with my snuggler of choice, counting the hours by how many times we get up to pee. I get to see and feel the suffering of the world and to take a nap when I feel like it anyway. I get to spend time with myself whenever I want. I get to feel more love than I ever thought existed. I feel this especially for you, though I may not remember exactly which you are. How cool is this?
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.